Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Thanks for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It is Thursday, March 20th. Today we hear from Governor Josh Green about the uncertainty ahead. There is so much beyond our control that will impact our economy and our everyday lives. Next week, we celebrate Prince Kohio's birthday. The monarch is credited with creating the Department of Hawaiian Homelands. We check in on the latest to get more lands in Native Hawaiian hands. We also hear from HART CEO Lori Kahikina about the October 1st opening of the next leg of our rail system. Will Skyline be ready or not? And we check in on healthcare bills that are still in play at the state legislature that could affect you. Tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Fear what the future may bring? Well, that's what we had a conversation about with Hawaii Governor Josh Green this morning on so many fronts. The state did offer to fast-track the hiring of federal workers who were laid off in the White House's efforts to reduce government spending. But then a court ordered the Trump administration to hire back those probationary employees who were fired. Here's Green.
Well, we're very fluid. I can only speak for the state, although we're obviously very fond of the city and county, and we work with them. We've had some job fairs. We've had 1,732 applicants so far, and we've made some initial offers. We're trying to turn this over in 14 days, and that's aspirational. Obviously, that's many months faster than usual when hiring at the state. We just want to be supportive, especially for people who live in Hawaii or our ohana, and kind of got this sudden termination from the federal government. So I think over the course of this spring, we'll see a lot of people come and start working for the state, and we're grateful for it.
Well, I think there may be many employees who just would like the stability, knowing that they have a job, as opposed to not knowing if the rug will get pulled out from them again with the feds.
Yes, exactly right. I think that's the largest motivator for people. You know, there's been this off again, on again position in some of the DOGE overtures that they would take people's jobs and then let them come back because, in a way, they hadn't fully anticipated which positions they were cutting. And that's very unsettling. So we hope to be stable. We're even hearing a bill that would change the amount of time it took to vest in the state, down from 10 years to 5 years. We'll see if that passes. But all things being equal, giving people a landing spot when we have a lot of need. Remember, we have over 4,000 openings in state government, and that means there's a lot of positions ranging from, you know, wonderful entry-level positions, some early clerk positions, all the way up through engineers and epidemiologists at the Department of Health and psychologists. There's all sorts of positions. So we're seeing a lot of people apply for tech, you know, IT specialists. We had 368 IT people apply. We need that too. We need civilians who are connected to the military that maybe are not making the cut and getting cut out of federal government work. So there's just a lot to do to help people.
Well, you know, we did talk to University of Hawaii economist Carl Bonham just after your meeting on Friday, and we asked him about the concern about Canadian visitors not coming to Hawaii. And I know at the time he'd said, well, we think we're okay on the Canadian side just because, you know, it's March and a lot of our snowbirds, you know, are returning. He said maybe next year was something to look at. But the morning paper indicates that your office and the Hawaii Tourism Authority, you've received some letters just to say, sorry, we're not mad at Hawaii, but we're mad at your president, and so we're not coming to Hawaii. So what are your thoughts about that?
That's been a concern, especially if there's a recession or if the tariffs affect Canada significantly. People might be struggling. And we have, you know, we've replaced a lot of the Japanese travelers since COVID and the COVID experience. We've replace them with travelers from Canada. They've been a great group of people to visit Hawaii. So that could happen. It's difficult to discern just from, you know, letters, because there's always going to be a few people that just are upset. And we recognize that. We encourage them to still come. We try to share with people that nothing could be more different than Hawaii than Washington, D.C. We are definitely the polar opposite of environments. And we will be welcoming. And I think a lot of people get that. But I just think if they're economically going through tougher times, they won't be able to travel. And that's more likely to be a cause of a downturn globally in travel if it happens. We still don't know. The tariffs are on one day and off the next, and you can't really guess yet at where all that lands. I think that that's a pretty large bargaining tool that the federal administration is using on people. And I'm hopeful that people still need their vacation and still need to get some respite from all of the ups and downs. And Hawaii is a great place to do it from Canada.
So you're not too worried about the immediate Canadian effect?
Not yet. I mean, I don't think we have any data yet. And we will get data to people as it comes in. So far, we still see a lot of people traveling to Hawaii. But if we have a global recession, that would be the most impactful thing. A deep recession, if it occurs as a result of some of the changes that are coming from the feds, that would hurt all of us, everyone in states that have a lot of hospitality. So let's hope that that settles down, because the last thing we need is a self-inflicted wound from a recession we don't need.
Well, we are waiting for so many shoes to drop, whether it's the Department of Education and federal funding for our public schools, or USDA and cuts to the school lunch program, or the funding at the University of Hawaii, which has brought in millions over the years in research money. But you know, what can you tell us about the concern for funding for the university because of the anti-Semitic complaint that got filed?
So there's two different kinds of cuts. I'm really glad you asked that, actually, that the university is worried about. One is just the pure cuts that they've been making, the federal government's been making towards research and programs that were granted through the legislative process by Congress. And we think those ultimately should be upheld and should stay in place, because it's the Congress who's supposed to determine these things. That's going to play out in court. We worry because sometimes it's been frozen and we have to push back. But that should get settled by the courts and the Congress, separate from what was a mistake, in my opinion, which was to suggest that the UH was anti-Semitic. Now, you know, I'm half Jewish. My mom is Christian. My dad's Jewish. I was raised in a Jewish household, so I'm very familiar with Judaism, and I'm familiar with anti-Semitic attacks. And then it was levied against us and 60 schools total across the country that there was anti-Semitic complaints. So I did contact the White House and said that was actually a question of colonialism. And they were very good points that were made by people on both sides of the argument, that the colonialism question was really causing a lot of conflict on campus. And in this case, the example was Israel and Palestine. But this was not anti-Semitism. And so after my conversation with the White House, they backed off and we came off that list. Other universities took it in the throat. They cut a huge amount of money from Columbia, for instance. Now, I can't fight the fights for other universities, really, but I can fight for UH. And it appears that the travels that I took early in the year to Washington are paying dividends, because I'm able to call some of the top five people in the U.S. government, the federal government, and make my case immediately in real time. Usually it's at like 4:30 in the morning when I wake up, and call them and say, wait a second, please pause on that. Same thing happened with the 442nd. They removed the 442nd, our heroes, the Japanese-American heroes that fought in World War II, from kind of the historical record in the military. And I was able to immediately contact them after talking to a lot of Japanese-American leaders here in Hawaii and just say, you're making a mistake. We can argue about DEI all day long, but that's not the thing here. So they also reversed that decision. So I'm expecting these next couple years to be years where I have to make a lot of calls and reach out to them and go to Washington and make the case that Hawaii is different. We're a truly diverse state. We don't have a majority population at all. And we are necessary for the Indo-Pacific. Our military support is critical to what America is trying to do. And by the way, if you have some extra workers for whatever reason, maybe we can help and hire them. So that's how I'm approaching things. And I got to tell you, I never expected to have this much contact with the Biden administration, and then Maui occurred, the wildfire, and I didn't expect to have this much contact with President Trump's administration, and then Elon Musk occurred. And so I kind of equate the carnage in some ways, because it's affecting everyone's life all the time. And that's how we felt when the tragedy occurred in Maui, all the time dealing with crisis.
I did get a chance to talk to our chief engineer, Board of Water Supply, Ernie Lau, who is also traveling to the mainland. You know, there's concern about the EPA getting cut and the commitment to funding the EPA and our regulators just to make sure that our situation with Red Hill and the water and the aquifer, they're going to be good on their word to clean up.
Yeah, we have to fight for that too. That's kind of like to make sure that promises are kept on Red Hill, and we've already gotten some early signs that the resources will still be there for the Maui recovery, the $1.6 billion. So the county of Maui needs to get those resources. Senator Schatz is going to be briefing us later today. So it's really day by day making sure that we get what we need to function. There are other things I'm actually pushing out. I was asked by the Trump administration to see if there was somewhere we could work on an environmental issue, and we're going to work on cesspools possibly. I gave them a proposal to help us remediate the cesspool problem that we have near our waters. We need to have that clean water, and the initial indication is maybe the EPA would work with us on that. It could be a very big win for our state and especially our counties and the mayors. So there's a lot to do. You know, I sometimes have to take a deep breath because I really can't say I love some of the decisions that have been made, especially by DOGE, but I can tell you that anybody who's in trouble, we will try to find a way to support them through this tough time.
Well, you know, whether it's the veterans or the folks who rely on Social Security, everybody's just nervous and fearful of what's to come. And if access to those benefits that they rely so greatly on, you know, is changed, it's not good for our mental health.
Right. It's not. I think that we have to actually recognize that. And changes this rapidly are traumatic. We actually even formed a trauma team, as you know, and we're a trauma-informed state, as an aside. But this kind of trauma accumulates, and everyone needs to have some kind of calm, safe space. And Hawaii will be that for us. It may actually be that for some people who decide to leave the mainland, honestly. It's hard to know, because I've gotten wind that some people are just, you know, they're over it on the mainland. But we have our own challenges here, so we're focusing on them. I can't predict when they're going to settle down. I think that it can't keep up at this pace. We are going to be watching this fall very carefully to see what kind of cuts do come into Medicaid and potentially Social Security. We're going to fight to the death to keep those cuts from occurring. And I've watched some of the conservative congressmen and women say some pretty terrible things about how they were going to balance the budget, essentially on the backs of people who are just living week to week and month to month. And that is not a way to support people. So you're talking about the fight of a lifetime in some ways, and I think just each and every day, the congressional delegation is going to have to do their part. I'm going to have to do my part. Lieutenant Governor will do her part. We're pretty well positioned overall, but I am intentionally not in a oppositional position against anybody because there's so much uncertainty.
Was there anything you want to leave our listeners with to help uplift our spirits at this time?
You know, March Madness is beginning for those basketball fans out there. Watch a lot of basketball. Eat protein. Don't eat too much carbs. But all things being equal, there are bright spots. You know, of course, I'm kidding a little bit, but the state has the capacity to help people for the next 2 years. Beyond that, I will need things to settle down very significantly before we start getting cut to the bone. But I think we're going to be okay. I want people to feel that. And it's a 24/7 operation right now to navigate the changes. I'm most worried about things overseas right now. Also, I'm worried about those wars, and I'm worried about innocent people getting caught up in the mix of that. So there's so many things on our minds, but if you're living in Hawaii, you're probably in the safest, most special place.
That was Governor Josh Green, who we talked to earlier this morning.
Support for HPR comes from HMSA. For over 85 years, committed to working together with employers, partners, and healthcare providers to support the health and well-being of the community. Learn more at hmsa.com.
Hey there, it's Sabrina Tavernisi, host of The Daily. Join us for an in-depth look at the world's biggest stories as they happen. Catch The Daily, Monday through Thursday evenings at 6:30. Here on HPR One.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Scheidler College of Business at UH Manoa, offering a Master of Accounting program. Learn more at scheidler.hawaii.edu.
Watson has been leading the charge as a returning director of the Department of Hawaiian Homelands. This year, he had asked state lawmakers for $600 million to help keep the momentum up and to get more Native Hawaiians into housing. But the Senate reduced that amount to $50 million. Watson, however, says he is still hopeful. There are about 29,000 Native Hawaiians on the wait list for homestead property. And the department has looked at different models to do that, not just building single-family homes, but townhouses and high-rise rentals, and continuing to massage the idea of reducing the blood quantum for inheritance eligibility from 50 to 25% or less. Here's Watson talking about the bill still in play at the legislature.
While we're still at the table, so to speak, in that they haven't decided to zero us out. The $50 million is the Senate position, but it remains to be seen. The bill, which is House Bill 606, actually came from the House side, led by the Hawaiian Caucus. So we're optimistic, and hopefully we'll get more funds, but we recognize that the very challenging times right now, especially with the situation with the federals.
Right.
Cutting off funds all over the place.
You were hoping to maybe leverage that and apply for some federal funding?
Well, we are applying for federal funding. Unfortunately, not as many sources are now available. There is some, but it's far a lot less. The earmarks were something we were looking at. This current budget, they eliminated earmarks, so that's no longer a source that we're looking at. So
yeah, we've got to be realistic then.
Realistic, but we're excited. We have about 29 projects in the pipeline, and this additional funding really is targeting the second phase of these 29 projects, including some of the new ones that were put in place. And we're also targeting new lands, which is not really a dollar amount, but really a transfer of lands into the program, which actually has the same impact. Rather than us, how we did in with the initial $600 million, we went out and we bought private lands to add to our inventory. We're now doing an assessment of all the different state lands around the state, and are going to move forward with trying to acquire some of that in lieu of acquiring private lands.
Talk about what you've got on tap for this year, because you're going to roll out some projects here pretty quick.
Yeah, we have quite a few projects around the state. On Saturday, we're doing a lease awards, project lease awards. We're close to 700 lots in Kapolei, which is our Ka'ulo Kahai, along with our Kaupea Phase 2 project. And so we're excited about that one. That's the first phase. We'll probably generate about, using the money that we have, about $140 million. We're going to apply to that to take down about maybe 450 of those paper lease awardees. That's why we need additional funds for the second phase, which involves about 250, which entails about $68 million. So it's an ongoing process, but at least we have the, and that's a, the idea is to award leases, homestead leases, to the entire project, and then part of it is subject to funding.
And you folks also have projects on the neighbor islands?
Oh, yeah, all over the place. Hawaii, Kauai, Maui, Molokai, including Lanai.
But the ones slated for this year?
Yeah, all of them. All the different islands. Like I said, we have about 28 projects.
Okay, but weren't you going to roll out three major ones this year?
Yeah, the major ones is Ka'ulo Kahai and Kaupea. And on the Big Island, we have the Laiopua project, where we're going to do about 400 new leases, actually more than that, but that's our significant one. And then we also have in the works our Lealii project in Lahaina. That's going to involve about 181 new leases. So we, as I said, we got projects all over the state. Some will take a little bit longer, like the projects on Maui. We have not only the Puhona, which is about 161 units. We also have the Wailuku, which is 207 units. And then a little further into Maui, there's the Waiehu Mauka, which is over 300 new units, which is a combo of not only single family, but subsistence ag lots. So that's another area we're kind of moving into, is the subsistence agricultural lots.
Yeah, talk about the different types of things that you're trying, because you've got the traditional leasehold properties. We also had the blessing for the
Bolodrome,
right? The rentals, the high-rise rentals.
Yeah, that one is 278 units high-rise. We're going to do a combo of condominiums along with townhouses. is seven townhouses adjacent to the stadium park, two-story, three bedrooms. That's a new one. Then on Kauai, we're doing about 84 townhouses. We renovated and upgrading these units. And that's, again, another new approach that the department has ever tried. And the idea is to get a little bit more density, but also take advantage of opportunities. In this case, it was an existing group of townhouses that were made available on the market. And so we stepped up and went after it, and we've been successful in acquiring it so far.
You're also going to try something different and lower the blood quantum for successors. So maybe explain to our listeners how that's going to work.
Well, the blood quantum situation is actually in Congress right now, and that involves reducing the blood quantum necessary for successors. In this case, we've got it down to 25%, but we're trying to, kind of consistent with what Prince Kuhio originally wanted, was to get all the way down to 1/32nd. This particular act that's in Congress right now is to do that, but you know, it remains to be seen whether it'll get through Congress, especially with the situation up there. But the idea is to get the blood quantum down because, as we all know, the 100% Native Hawaiian blood quantum is very minimal, and we're seeing more and more people getting kind of left out as the blood quantum dissipates. That's something we need to address. The reality of the situation is that there are less 50%ers, there's more 25%, especially heirs. And then even that, you know, our wait list is the majority are elderly Native Hawaiians or kupuna. And so while they might have minimum 50%, unfortunately, as they age and pass away, you know, their heirs might be only 25%. That's why we're doing the paper Project Lease Awards, is to eliminate that unfortunate situation. If they pass away and their heirs are only 25% and they don't have a lease, their kids lose out. So that's why these paper project leases are so important. Get them to the beneficiaries that are kupuna especially, and then should they pass away, they have a lease that they can pass on to their heir, which may be only 25% Hawaiian.
And that's what the case is over at the Kapolei project that's opening this weekend?
Exactly. We're doing this Saturday, we're going to do close to 700 project paper leases. Now, that just gets them to the table. Then they have the four different options where they can do the turnkey, where they got to pre-qualify for a loan. That's on them. And then there's also, if they're lower income, below 50%, or 60% AMI or area median income, they can participate in this program where there's subsidies from the federal and state, which pays for maybe 60 to 70% of the cost of the project. And then there's a 15-year compliance period where you know, they got to pay rent, which is affordable. They also got to restrict who lives in the unit, consistent with the area median income. And then they have to be subject to annual certification regarding income, as well as inspections. Now, if they want to go through that and are amenable to those restrictions, then they have the option of participating. If they don't, it's their choice. They don't have to. And then we have the Habitat. We're working with them. And then also the owner builder where they build their own house.
Habitat for Humanity.
Yeah, that's where you put in sweat equity. You get a 0% interest loan. And you help build their house.
So Native Hawaiians have more options.
Exactly. Before, the only option was you have to pre-qualify for a loan. If you don't and you can't, you're out. You sit on the side and, you know, stay frustrated or you die on the waiting list, which we want to change that. So that's where we're creating more options, more opportunity. We also added to that the transitional housing. We're doing a project out in Maile where if you don't fit any of those categories, then you can, move into a multi-unit rental unit, and then you pay affordable rents, and then we'll have different entity service organizations that will provide you the counseling and put you in a position where you can qualify for one of those approaches and then become a homesteader.
And is that project the one where you're having to displace current renters?
Most of them have left, so the facility is primarily vacant, but I wouldn't call it displaced. It's more we're going to be under construction, so it's necessary that obviously while you're doing construction, it can't be occupied.
Yes, but I think there are so many other projects, you know, on the private sector too, where, you know, you are displacing lower income housing units, you know, for other families. And then, you know, where do those original renters go? So it's a tough spot to be in.
Well, with the projects such as the one we have on Kauai, the Waipahuli project, we're required by law, the federal law mandates that we have to provide relocation funding for their expenses and then also look for replacement housing for them. So we're doing that per a plan that has to be submitted and approved by the federal government, HUD. And so that we're in compliance, or we'll be in compliance when those requirements kick in.
I do have to ask, though, you know, because there's a lot of uncertainty around tariffs. How are you looking at the construction costs for the projects that you're trying to roll out?
Well, that is going to be something that is going to impact, I think, especially with uncertainty as to whether it's tariffs or no tariffs. But in any event, costs invariably have been going up, including labor costs, including source of supplies. So these are all issues that we need to address, and that's where we have contingency funding on the side to address those costs. There's also the ability to, if it's a tax credit project, you go in to HHFDC and you ask for more credits or tax credits, so you can up the revenue generated from the sale of those credits to, pay for these higher costs.
We are in a very difficult time right now. But What else do you want to leave our listeners with as we approach Prince Kuhio Day?
Well, the day before Prince Kuhio Day, on March 25th, which is a Tuesday, from 9 to 12 noon, we're going to have what we call a Kuhio Kako Unity Rally. We invite all the supporters of the program to come down to the state capitol and show your support. Because we're in our HB 606 bill has passed the Senate as well as the House. So it's really a matter of how much are they going to give us in addition to the $600 previously awarded. So that, obviously, the more we get, the more people on the 29,000 waiting list can be addressed. So we're asking for the support and come to the rally. Show your presence, show your support for the program, and let our legislators know that this is a need that needs to be addressed, not only by them, but the entire state, and an acknowledgement that when we became a state, the Hawaiian Homes Commission Act, servicing and making a move for it was part of the conditions to statehood, which the state accepted, and thereby that's why we have the Department of Hawaiian Homelands. But it costs money to carry out the building of homes, putting in infrastructure, and so we need additional money. We're looking to do, you know, close to over 3,000 with the initial 600 million. But as I mentioned, we got over 29,000, so we need more money. We need $6 billion. Obviously, we're not going to get that, but I think the 600 was a step in the right direction. But we need more steps. We want to get we want to carry the momentum, and we're appreciative of the initial 600, but we need more.
Okay. Well, Kali Watson, thank you so much for your time this morning.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me on.
That was Kali Watson, Director of the Department of Hawaiian Homelands, who talked with us earlier today.
As a nonprofit statewide broadcaster, Hawaii Public Radio is always exploring different ways to serve you. We've compiled highlights from the last year in our annual report. It's an opportunity for you to see what HPR has been up to, and an opportunity for us to thank our community supporters, including you. Download HPR's annual report at hawaiipublicradio.org/report.
On the next Living on Earth, President Trump is slashing personnel at the EPA.
Unfortunately, many of those with the institutional knowledge that you need left. I think they're leaving because it's clear this administration does not want an environmental protection agency.
Former Republican EPA Administrator Christine Todd Whitman, I'm Paloma Beltran, and that's next time on Living on Earth from PRX.
Beginning this evening at 7.
This week, in a State of the City address, Honolulu Mayor Rick Blangiardi announced that Skyline would open its next leg from the stadium to Middle Street in October of this year. That's just 7 months away. Hart CEO Lori Kaikina had indicated earlier that the opening would be later this year, but had not committed a specific date. So, is October doable or not? We talked to Kaikina this morning. I read in the newspaper that you seemed kind of surprised at the mayor's pronouncement of October, and we have only been waiting forever for this not on time and not on budget project. But October 2025, right. Can or no can?
Oh, my goodness. You know how a mayor is. So he did the same thing to us in segment one. I kept telling him summer, summer, summer. No, I want to say a date. No, say summer, mayor, because our reputation, right? We want to under-promise and over-deliver. And 2 weeks before his State of the City address, he says, Lori, I want to give a month. I said, okay, fine. Just say whatever, August, September. That's end of the summer, right? And then the night of his State of the City address, it's July. I'm like, oh, there really was a gasp in the room coming from me and Rick Keene. And he did it again this time. He says, Lori, I want to give a month. I said, oh, gosh, mayor, please say end of the year. No, I'm going to say October. I'm like, oh, no. So he gave me a little bit of a heads up that he was going to say October 1, but I still wanted to tell everyone that night when he said October 1, I stood up and I said, end of the year. But as soon as I came in the next morning, yesterday morning, I sent an email to my team, which includes Hitachi, DTS, and Hart Ohana, that, okay, mayor has drawn the line in the sand again for us. It's October 1st. Let's do everything in our power to get this done by then. We'll get it done and open and transferred over to DTS. But, you know, by him saying opening October 1st, that actually backs us up a little bit more because we need to give time to transfer over to DTS, and they determine actually when they open for revenue service. But we will know a little bit more solid in our schedule when Hitachi goes into trial running July, just like what we had to do for segment one. We do trial running, and then after all of the testing and commissioning is done, then we go into system demonstration where we budgeted, I want to say, about 45 days, and Hitachi did it in 35. So we're hoping they can pull it off again in segment two, and we can hit that October 1st deadline for mayor.
Yes, and you know, when we talked before, I know you had given the public a heads up like, oh, you know, as we do this testing of the whole operational system, that you've got to take down the whole system just to be safe and make sure we do this thing right and nobody gets hurt. We did close the system down on the weekends, and that seemed to go well. So that was positive. Yeah. And hopefully the same thing will happen as you need to do all your checks before this October opening.
Yeah, no, I'm so glad you brought that up, Catherine, because I do want to make it so public that we are not going to cut corners just to meet that October 1st deadline. We have to make sure everything is safe. And it's not just heart safety, just like in segment one, we have FTA, we have DTS safety, we have HDOT safety. All three entities above and beyond heart have to sign off that everything is safe and ready to go for passengers. So yes, we will not cut any corners. And the other point you brought up, it is much more difficult for our team and Hitachi because we have a live system going on in segment one. We didn't have that issue when we opened in 2023. And there's what we call engineering hours. So there's live passengers, right? Maybe from 5 a.m. to 7 p.m. And so there's only a few hours in the evening on the weekdays and a few hours on the weekend that we can do this testing. And yes, you're right. We shut down over the weekend to do the migration of information from segment one and two. Now we're going to have to run it engineering hours, take down segment one and bring the two segments together and do this testing. That's the dilemma, is there's only limited hours that they can do this testing without impacting the riders during the regular working hours. bottom line, we will do everything we can, but we will not be cutting corners.
Yes, and we can understand where the mayor's coming from. You know, he wants to see results. We have been waiting a very long time for this. And, you know, we've watched it come up incrementally, and it doesn't help everybody. And so that's why you don't have a lot of riders on at this point. So I don't know it's going to be that big of a deal, maybe if we wait another month or two, if something happens. But, you know, I have to say, you know, we did have something unexpected happen where we had that terrible plane crash, that small plane. And I was just very worried because it came very close. And I'm sure the pilots, you know, were thinking about, oh, my gosh, there's the rail guideline.
I'm sure and
I know that they realigned the route for that very fact, right? Because of the FAA and the concerns for small planes.
I actually have goosebumps, Catherine. We, for the first time, road segment two, we had FTA here visiting for our quarterly meeting. And we took them on segment two, myself, Rick, FTA. This is our first time riding, and it was that morning. And we were there 1 hour before that crash. And I can only imagine what those pilots were doing because the train was right there.
Oh, my gosh.
To your point, you know, did they divert so that, you know, they didn't hit the train? They didn't hit the guideway. I have goosebumps right now just thinking of what they did.
Well, those are things.
Definitely tragic. Yeah.
Those are things that you can't really plan for, and you know, the federal authorities had that in mind when they realigned that area by the airport. But there are just some things out of your control, and so you just don't know what's going to happen.
No, absolutely, and you're right. So the flight path, if you look at that curve coming into the airport station, it's the highest point when we're coming into the station, and it's an S curve. And the reason it's designed that way, the highest point, is because the largest plane that's on the tarmac, if it needed to come back up against the guideway, the tail would fit underneath. And then when you come out of the airport station, you're coming down towards Lagoon, that's the lowest point. And that's because of the flight path. We had to bring it down in the YY loop area so that the flight path, we were underneath it. Like you said, we try the best we can, but we couldn't possibly have foreseen that happening.
You know, as we are hearing and reading the stories about the tariffs, the trade war, I know the first thing that I wondered about was the price of steel. But I was told by your folks that under the federal contract that the steel has to be U.S. produced.
Yes. As long as there is just even one federal dollar in a project, it now becomes federalized, and you have to adhere to all of the requirements, and one of them is exactly that. It's Buy America. So the tariffs that are being instilled right now on different resources and commodities, part is not impacted because we are already mandated to purchase our supplies from American vendors.
So whether it's steel or concrete or
or
whatever we need for the rail stations, that's all U.S. made.
Yes, should not be affected by the tariffs.
Although, you know, we are hearing that the prices could still go up, and construction prices are on the rise anyway.
Oh, exactly. No matter what is going on with the tariffs, you're right. Even without that, prices constantly go up every year.
Well, I have to ask, because this month I happened to see in the newspaper and the public notices that Hart was planning, I think, to acquire land in the Dillingham area. And most of the property seemed to be Kamehameha Schools property.
It is. And we've been working for years with them, and they are absolutely terrific partners. And it's not the dollar amount. You know, actually, I should watch what I say. I'm going to have my attorneys calling me. But just know they have been terrific partners. And I called Jack Wong to let him know that we're running out of time. We cannot hold up, especially Tudor Perini, the CCGS contractor. And he understood. He understood I needed to make this difficult decision, and we're moving forward with that.
Yes, and hopefully that's so that you can do what you need to do to finish the undergrounding and get that line up into town.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Is there anything else you can share with our listeners about that last leg? Because we're hoping that you do open in October or before the end of the year, you know, for the leg to Middle Street. But there is that leg to get down to the city center, and that work is still underway.
Yes. So that work right now is scheduled for 2031. That's a no float schedule. So, you know, depending on any difficulties that we may encounter coming down into the downtown area, it could adjust, and you know, several years off. So we closely monitor it. Of course, our primary focus right now is getting segment two open and ready. But for segment three, the downtown utility work with Colucci, our contractor, should be wrapping up within the next few months, summer of this year. Dillingham utility relocation, they should be done next year, about the same time, summertime. And actually, you should start to see columns going up this summer. Tudor Perini has already started their borings, and they're going to start putting columns in the Ivalay area and, you know, work out all of the bugs and how they are forming the work. And their desire is to have a second heading, which is down in Halekawila. So you might see columns starting to come up shortly in that area as well. But again, final schedule is 2031, barring no unforeseen difficulties.
And I do have to ask, just because of the federal uncertainty, you feel okay about any other federal reimbursements that we're going to need to ask for?
Sure. That is a main concern of all the city departments, I guess statewide, nationally, actually. So we have our connections in Washington, D.C., and we are questioning this because of that $744 million that FTA was withholding since 2017, we've received about half of it. So as of December, before the administration changed, we received the $125 million when we amended the full funding grant agreement. We received another $250 million when we awarded City Center Guideway Station. And then the last three tranches is when we finish Dillingham. So that's another $125 million. When we open segment two, that's another $125 million. And then the last $119 million, there's no milestone tied to that. So just to repeat, I had the timing flipped, right? So when we open segment two later on this year, we will be eligible for $125 million. When we finish Dillingham utility relocation next year, that's another $125 million. And then the last $119 million, we need to work with FTA when we could possibly receive that last tranche. So there's over $300 million outstanding that we're hoping that it's not in jeopardy. It is a contract right now with FTA, and I understand it has already been appropriated, but you never know what's going on in D.C. right now.
All right. Well, we'll keep our fingers crossed for that and keep our fingers crossed for October 1st. But thank you so much, Lori, for your time today.
Thank you, Catherine. Always a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you.
We've been hearing from HART CEO Lori Kaikina about the mayor's announcement that the next leg of our rail system, Skyline, is to open October 1st of this year. The cost of health care is a growing concern for everyone. So when you need medical care, will your insurance cover it? Well, here to talk about efforts to improve the system is HPR's government reporter, Ashley Mizzuo. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah, so what have we got on tap at the legislature?
Yeah, so one of the key things that doctors and other types of physicians are really concerned about is this insurance practice called prior authorization. And that's when healthcare providers need approval from the insurer before they can deliver, you know, medical services or medications. So prior authorization was created originally to, you know, curb unnecessary treatments, or it was a kind of cost-saving measure for the price of medicine. But now doctors are saying that prior authorization is needed for a whole host of different types of services and medications that didn't used to require it. It's become a really big administrative burden for doctors. And then in turn has also the long wait times for that prior authorization have sometimes driven patients to abandon care or just go to the ER instead to receive those medical services. So how does prior authorization work? Well, basically, the doctor's office will have to fill out paperwork providing information to the insurance company about why this treatment is necessary. And then sometimes the doctor will then need to get on the phone with the insurance's doctor to do what's called a peer-to-peer review. Here's Dr. Elizabeth Ann Ignacio, president of the Hawaii Medical Association.
It's maddening to try and break out of your clinical interactions so that you can have a peer-to-peer review. And then sometimes you're dealing with folks who don't necessarily understand. They're not in the same specialty as you, so they don't quite understand. Well, I thought the CT would be good enough for this. Why can't an MRI be like that? Why can't we use something easy like ultrasound? And you're trying to explain to them, that won't work. That won't answer the question. So yes, it takes an inordinate amount of time. It takes so long. And it's frustrating when you think that if we spend this much time every day and every week, automatically that's subtracting time from our patients. And ultimately, that really wears and tears and burns out our providers.
I can see that.
Yeah. And, you know, according to a survey done by the Hawaii Area Health Education Center, on average, physicians and their staff spend about 20 hours a week working on just prior authorization. So none of the other insurance issues, just prior authorization. And a third of doctors actually have to have at least one full-time person dedicated to just working on prior authorization. This gets especially difficult when we're talking about neighbor islands, which might have less doctors or resources there. And so doctors are having to weigh, you know, do I spend the time working on this prior authorization paperwork for this patient I've already seen, or do I see a new patient, or do I just stay way late into the night to try to, you know, go through all this paperwork that they're not necessarily being compensated for. The biggest issue regarding prior authorization, though, amongst doctors is that there's no shared standard among insurance providers for what requires prior authorization. So that means something that maybe an HMSA patient could require a prior authorization for some type of procedure, but another patient in the exact same situation with the policy at like UHA or Kaiser wouldn't. Chris Peel is the medical director at Hawaii Island Community Health Center.
They don't know which standards they're going off of, and they might not be based off the most current standards. They might just be based off maybe what's the most restrictive. And so I think that's really challenging to just keep up with what are your technical administrative requirements around submitting this, and then what are your clinical guidelines.
And, you know, there are services like MRIs, CT scans, blood tests, or even medication for those with diabetes are things that require prior authorization sometimes from insurance companies. And so doctors are kind of having to navigate, well, this patient's with HMSA, and generally speaking, like HMSA has prior authorization for this things, and this patient has UHA health insurance, so they might have prior authorization for these other procedures. And you're really just trying to have to like navigate between these different insurance companies what procedures you're going to have to fill out all this prior authorization paperwork for, and then possibly do the peer-to-peer review. Dr. Kahuimanu Deng Akiona is a family physician with the Association of Native Hawaiian Physicians, and she says that she's had patients abandon care just because of how long it takes for the prior authorization to come through. And other patients, particularly those in pain, will instead just go to the emergency room.
A lot of them are opting to go the emergency department route, which I don't recommend, but you know, they're out of frustration. When the pain's getting worse, a lot of times they end up going, and you know, 100% could have been prevented if we just kind of had a better process to address their concerns in a timely way. It affects how they engage with the healthcare system. It has over time affected their trust, you know, in kind of how things are going to happen, and it definitely has impacted our ability to do our job.
So how come they can't just standardize this stuff?
Yeah, and I think that that's the biggest question so far, is they're trying to decide, like, it's not really up to the doctors necessarily to do these standards, even though, you know, doctors have kind of a standardized form of care. It's kind of just been up to the insurance policies individually to decide what they think requires prior authorization. Of course, they do, in fact, have to use some type of medical standards to make those decisions. But like Chris Peel said earlier, it's really arbitrary on which standards they're using, like from whatever different type of care standard that they're looking at. It's not a uniform thing that they all need to follow. And, you know, for an added perspective, the significant majority of prior authorization requests are actually just approved in the end. HMSA says it approves 90% of prior authorization requests. And then for those that get denied initially, 83% are overturned and then approved by the health plans after the doctor appeals the decision.
They just like torture.
Yeah, it's just going back and forth and back and forth. And, you know, because of this, that same Area Health Education Center survey found that 90% of doctors said that prior authorization resulted in patients not adhering to the treatment plan they had discussed. And 40% say that it resulted in a serious adverse event for the patient. So right now, there are two bills before the legislature that would create a type of, you know, working group with insurance providers and doctors to come up with those standards that you were asking about earlier. But I will note that it's not going to impose these standards on the insurance companies. It would instead, that working group would put out a report and it would act as recommendations for the insurance companies to adopt, as well as other types of health organizations and the doctors themselves, to work through those recommendations and try to adopt them voluntarily. They would also, the insurance policies would also need to report prior authorization data to the State Health Planning and Development Agency. Agency Director Dr. Jack Lewin says those are the steps that can kind of push the system to become better.
I'd like to be a facilitator of solving those kind of problems rather than being some kind of heavy-handed regulator. And on the other hand, there are times when you need regulation, you know, and that's when you do it this nice way and then nobody changes. Then you got to go the other way. But I think we'll be able to accomplish a lot just by sharing accurate data with people.
So essentially, it's they're trying to work in a way that's more collaborative between insurance companies and physicians who are both being burdened by the system. You know, HMSA wrote in their testimony that it does take, you know, administrative burdens on the insurance companies themselves to also go through this process. And so SHPTA is saying basically, like, if we could get both of these parties to come together and work together out a solution, then hopefully they'll self-impose these on themselves and make this process a little more streamlined.
Yeah, so cut through the red tape and stop torturing all of us.
Yeah. And, you know, they're purposely not mandating anything in these bills because they want that to facilitate the conversation. They really want the I think, parties to push themselves internally to be better and automate their system a little bit more so that they're not, you know, working through all of these different types of administrative burdens.
Yeah, let's just all get along. But thanks so much, Ashley.
Thanks.
All right, we've been hearing from Ashley Mazzu, our government reporter. Look for her stories on hawaiipublicradio.org. Well, that does it for us today. Tomorrow, we have a Hanaho show planned. Award winners in our Hawaii Nē. We do welcome feedback. Call or talk back line 808-792-8217 or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find The Conversation as a podcast on Spotify, Apple, or on our website. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.